House of Comments. I'm here, and Emma Bonnell. I'm Charlotte Henry, and I'm here, and Emma Bonnell is here as well.
Hello, Charlotte Henry.
Hello. Yes, thank you. I forgot my name for a moment. Listen, it's a Friday. What can you do? Actually, I'm furious at you this week.
Well, I mean, there's usually a good reason, but what have I done now?
You made me read a significant portion of the Gordon Brown Commission on Constitutional Reform.
This is absolutely not true. I will open my text to you and say what I said.
The text clearly says, am I interested in this? You said yes.
I am very interested in it. But what I also say, hang on a second. Hold on. Hold on just one moment, Missy. I said, read the exec summary like any good journalist.
And I did read the exec summary. Now, let's just explain to our listeners quite what this commission is. It is a commission on constitutional reform, basically, political institutional reform. I should say right at the top of the show, I did some work on this for the Lib Dems on a working paper. I was part of a group that did that, I mean, a million years ago, 2014, I think our paper came out. But this is a topic I'm interested in. It's a topic you're interested in.
I worked for 3 years for a local government think tank, so all the devolution stuff, which I'm far more interested in, frankly, than the House of Lords crap.
That's interesting. Okay, we'll get into that. So for me, the big thing is the House of Lords. Let's not talk about it like this is only Gordon Brown. There is a very capable group of people that worked with Gordon Brown on this, as is, you know, often the case. It's not just one person. He, for obvious reasons, is the front person for this.
Yeah.
But
and he's been leading that commission for, I think, 2 years at least.
Yeah, it's a significant piece of work, but it's not just him. There are some very, you know, serious, sensible people who work on the front lines of this kind of stuff, as far as I can tell, from lawyers to local government leaders who have been involved in this. So, as you said, there's two key parts to this. One is recommendations for reforming the House of Lords. Like the TLDR version of this is that he wants the House of Lords to be significantly made smaller. This is one of the commission's recommendations, and it to be a home of the kind of nations and regions. That's where it's represented. And then there's lots of devolution stuff in there as well. So I think let's start at the kind of national big level and talk about the House of Lords stuff.
I would say there's a third pillar, which is about the relationship between the UK government and the devolved nations as well.
Yep, absolutely. So, this commission is obviously correct to point out that the House of Lords in its current form is no longer fit for purpose. It is frankly absurd that you can have a significant legislative body. Now, we know that the House of Lords doesn't actually stop legislation, but it can delay it, it can alter it, it can put up a fight. And basically, it's now become a house of cronies and political donors. And we all like to kind of romanticize that it's a house of experts and so on. And there are some genuinely brilliant people.
There are some wonderful experts in there, but they're no longer anything like a majority.
I agree with that.
I say no longer. I'm not sure they ever were. They're not a significant majority. And the majority that used to be just landed cronies who nicked all our land hundreds of years ago is now people who've spadded for David Cameron.
I mean, there's all sorts of people in there that from, you know, various political points of view. And I also think the kind of recommendation system has been abused, frankly, by all parties to the point of absurdity. You know, it's been made very apparent with the number of prime ministers that have had to go. And, you know, the idea Liz Truss has the right after 6-7 weeks to appoint a bunch of people to the House of Lords is obviously so absurd, it's laughable.
Yeah.
That's all a given, but I do have some concerns about the recommendations here. And what worries me is you will sort of get a US style system of just confrontation and nothing can get done.
That is always the threat with any democratic system, particularly one that's proportional. Because we are at the moment a country that is fairly proportionally divided. And that may be less and less true as the Tories at the moment get tired, but if the Lords are appointed on a longer term basis, that will generally work out to be true. I mean, this is it's the old Churchill thing, isn't it? Democracy is crap except for everything else.
Yep. But it does, like when you look at the kind of standoffs, legislative standoffs you have in the United States, it does worry me that you have that, you know, whatever we think of Boris Johnson and his government, they earned an 80 seat majority and therefore the right to get stuff done, whether you and I liked it or not.
Yes.
And you know, if Keir Starmer gets a 30-40 seat majority next election, the same rules apply.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this is why any redesigned House of Lords has to have very specifically limited powers to revision rather than blockage.
And that is made clear if you delve into, you know, I did go beyond the executive summary and read some of the end bits of the House of Lords in particular. And they do try and make it clear, this commission, that they don't want it just to be, you know, a blocking house. It does have the right to delay. There is this thing that I couldn't quite get my head around, so we're not going to spend too much time on it, about it reserves the right particularly to block, well, only to block stuff around the Constitution.
Yeah.
It has the right to also agree with the government, but to block constitutional legislation. But apart from that, really, it's a delaying and revising house, which is as it is. Another question for you. You know, we've talked about the kind of House of Experts that we would all idealise the House of Lords perhaps to be, if it's not going to be democratically elected. My fear always when you talk about an elected House of Lords is that lots of good people get put off being a politician because of politics, this again might apply to people that you might want in a revising chamber.
It will. I mean, there's just fundamentally that will happen. When you go for election, that changes who's going to sit in that house.
Mm.
That is the trade-off. There are no perfect systems where we elect 100 Robert Winstons to sort everything out for us.
Oh my God, that's so weird. That was who I was thinking of.
It's who everyone thinks of because he's brilliant.
In sync, Emma.
And that is literally just, that's the trade-off. There's no more to be said than that is the trade-off. What I hope would happen, although have no strong feeling that it would necessarily, is that there would be significant space created for advising to the revision chamber, so that the elected peers, who will be party apparatchiks from all of the parties, and I have slight worries about list systems and how they just end up with, you know, not necessarily the best individuals. But I think what I would fight for is a system that had that, but also had a really, really strong committee system, I suppose, that it ensured that the advice that we currently get from sitting peers was available, and that those sitting peers could be outside of that living their lives.
So hang on, your take is that maybe some of the appointees currently would still remain in the second chamber?
No, not remain. I doubt they'd remain in the second chamber. No, that they would still have a role as advisory.
Oh, that's interesting.
So coming into things like giving and being witnesses at select committees,
sure,
but in a big, but bigger and better, and committees that were taken more seriously.
Okay. There's an interesting point actually in this report when they're talking about the powers of the House of Lords, and the commission notes, and I'm quoting directly from the report, the unelected House of Lords acts as a safeguard for democracy in the United Kingdom. And that's basically because one of the only beyond delaying powers it has is it can stop the government basically changing legislation to extend its term. So basically government can't keep voting for itself, which is quite an interesting point that I'd never thought of before. And they say, we recommend that the new chamber retains this power and that the power should be extended in one area only, to legislation relating to certain other constitutional statutes, which we refer to here as protected constitutional statutes. Basically, what I was saying before, that if the government wants to alter the constitution, the House of Lords will have, this new chamber will have powers to stop that if it feels it's not correct. The other thing is, this new chamber, I believe, is meant to be significantly smaller. Did I hear 200?
200, I think, yeah.
Kind of members, peers, whatever we're going to call them now. So that's...
200 is an interesting number. It should absolutely be an uneven number.
Oh, yes. I hadn't thought of it, but yes, you're right. Of course it should.
I mean, just make it 201 or 199, but for goodness sake, don't have a round number. It just is asking for trouble.
Yes, we'll come to the Senate in America later in the show for evidence of why it leads to trouble. But yes, you're absolutely right. It should obviously be 199, 201, 249, 251. Yeah. I have no objection. In fact, I think I actively approve of a smaller... I mean, I think you can make good cases that both chambers should be smaller, frankly.
I mean, I disagree with you on the House of Commons. I was against the reduction to 600.
Because you think not enough people would get represented properly?
Yes. Okay. The House of Commons is, and the Boundary Commission is all done on voters,
yep,
not people who live in constituents. And that means that places like mine, dense urban populations with lots of transient refugees who aren't allowed to register for votes, children, yep, etc., are not represented. And if you say you numerically have to have 70,000 people, well, 70,000 quite middle-class people in Tunbridge Wells have a lot fewer constituency problems than 70,000 considerably poorer people in urban regions. And so it actually leads, I think, to a disparity of representation.
Okay, I can be conversant in that, yeah. And also, I suppose, if you have... The thing with reducing the House of Commons is also you can have very different areas very close to each other.
Yeah.
And so representing, you know, they can be very different and also not particularly feel a connection between, yeah, each other.
I mean, you just have to, I mean, even within the constituencies we've got now, if you look at Kensington and Chelsea and the fact that it went Labour in 2017.
The classic example, yeah.
It is a classic example. Or Tower Hamlets is another, yep, one. You know, extraordinary levels of wealth next to extraordinary levels, yeah, of poverty.
Yep. So you've mentioned your interest and experience in devolution, local government, those kind, yeah, of things. Explain a bit what this commission recommends on that and what your take on that is.
Well, it's much more devolved powers. Firstly, to the regional mayors, and you know, we're seeing more and more of these devolution deals. I think one just went through in Norfolk this morning. Norfolk, one for Norfolk and one for Suffolk, I think, which is quite interesting. So these devolution deals, as they sit, are okay. They're good, but they're quite piecemeal. They're quite different around the country, and they have disparate, differing levels of power, and they are all still gripped by the Treasury, because that's where all the money comes from. And one of the things this is saying is that we have to stop that central command of money, because that's a central command of power. And so we're talking about different ways of having local government pots of money be decided by local people, but also some local tax raising powers as well, beyond you might be able to raise your council tax 5% if local people vote for it, which of course they're going to do.
Yeah, yeah. Please raise my council tax.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like, I mean, I'm in favour. I probably would be the one person down there voting yes, because I, you know, have worked for a local government thing. I know that this aggregated money is important, but nobody really. That's never going to pass.
No.
I'm not stupid. I'm just, you know, naive.
Not naive, Emma. Hopeful. You're hopeful.
Optimistic, yeah. but so this is, it's interesting because Brown was never, ever that guy.
I didn't like, I'm glad you said it, not me, because the idea, yeah, of Gordon Brown
was Treasury orthodoxy for over a decade.
And also turned the Treasury into a massive,
into the
massive
powerhouse that it is, absolutely.
That was his power base. So yeah, I confess I did have a chuckle as I was reading this.
But you know, there's no zealot like a convert. We all welcome a good convert. So I'm and on the other hand, it is a bit of a Nixon goes to China thing. You know, if anyone can say, right, I've seen both sides and now this is the side I come down on, Gordon Brown is the guy who's probably got the most credibility to do that in the Labour Party. Because that centralisation versus decentralisation fight is as long, I mean, my whole life that's been an argument within the Labour Party, and it goes back and forth. But I'm a genuine believer in localism, in much more local power, power to local communities, power to local government. So I'm really keen on most of the devolution ideas in this. I really do think, I think that there's a chicken and egg problem with local government, because everyone goes, oh, well, they're not good enough. You know, you're second. There's a reason for that. The reason it doesn't attract, you know, the same caliber is because there's nothing you can do with it. You make it an attractive proposition for people to go into, then you're going to get more talent and interest in it.
So I absolutely agree with that. I also think it could solve another problem. And I think this might be a problem that the Lib Dems caused, which is this idea of MPs as super councillors.
Yes.
Which, you know, I think I mentioned this before on the show, you know, the Lib Dems decided MPs had to be the local person that picking up the rubbish on a Sunday morning and going to deal with very localised issues. And that really wasn't what MPs were ever designed for.
No.
They were designed to represent their area in its broadest sense on a national level. So I think
I
it could
realise that because I've come from working out, I'm wearing a scruffy old T-shirt, and that scruffy old T-shirt is from my days at NLGN when we had set up what we called an innovation bar at the LGA conference. God, millions and billions of years ago. I think it was 2015.
So thank you, Emma, for making me feel bad that you've already done a workout before we record the show, and all I've done is have a cup of tea. Thank you. Really appreciate that. But yeah, I do.
Well, tell you the other thing I did this morning, but it also involved exertion.
I don't want to. I mean, Smudge, your cat is looking ashamed at you behind you on this. But yes, I can't finish the sentence there. I do think that this could solve multiple problems. Like I say, this idea of MPs as super councillors really does need to stop.
Absolutely. And no, MPs are just at the moment, they're like half councillor, half social worker. And it's not, they're supposed to be primarily legislators.
Exactly. And I also think you might get this idea of more people going to their local council to solve local problems if, you know, the powers are extended. The one bit I do have a concern about, again, is all these multiple tiered levels, which is, if you followed every example that they recommend in this report, you would have a very multi-tiered government. And I fear that puts people off because they don't know who to go to. It makes it easier for politicians to pass things off and on to other people and not take responsibility. I think it can become quite messy. Now, I am naturally, this won't surprise you to know, inclined to decentralise things, to bring in the way you described, to bring things closer to local people. I am naturally inclined to all those things. But the mess, you know, it's a bit like we were saying about the House of Lords, and, you know, that can become messy and you can get political standoffs. The trade-off here is you might bring things closer to local people, but things could get a bit confusing and messy and not very, you know, there might not be clear responsibility and all those things I've just said.
I'm less concerned about the impact of that on local people knowing where to go, because I think that's fairly surmountable. What I think you will have is a lot of local tussling.
Exactly. That's another very good point.
That might well happen within. So let's take Greater Manchester, for example. You've got the leader of Manchester City Council, which is the biggest council within the area. Then the leader
I correct? One of the biggest councils and most powerful councils in the country.
It's not as big as Birmingham, but it is. Yeah. I mean, it's right up there. Who a lot of whose powers were taken up into the role of Greater Manchester Mayor.
Yep.
Then you have the other local councillors. So there are complexities around this, absolutely. And what you will at some point, it won't necessarily be Manchester, it won't necessarily be Liverpool or Birmingham or whatever, but you'll have intra-party fights.
Yep.
Or you'll have so what they already have in Birmingham is the West Midlands Mayor Andy Street's a Conservative and the Birmingham City Council is Labour. And there are fewer complexities than it seems. They do seem to work together. You're not hearing endless briefing against each other, and they do seem to work in partnership quite well.
But that may also be as much down to the, you know, personalities involved.
Well, that's it. Yeah, you get
Andy Street doesn't strike me as a particularly unreasonable person. He seems a quite centrist, practical, get stuff done person.
I mean, he's a former head of John Lewis, so it seems like he's sort of on the cuddlier end of conservatism. But that won't always be the case, and it shouldn't always be the case, because there will be some places that will want to elect a much more spiky Tory or a much more left-wing Labour person, and they will then inevitably clash with other people.
Yep, yep.
And that again, is democracy. There is no tidy answer to all of this, and that's what I think we have to let go of.
Yeah, I understand that, and I probably, again, kind of agree with you on that. It just worries me that that puts off voters. It's very easy for voters to go, oh, they just argue with each other, they don't get anything done, I'm not voting. And I think the one thing we really need to overcome, and actually, to be fair to this commission, they clearly understand this is an issue, is political apathy, political disengagement, political distrust. And the intentions of this commission are trying to solve some of those problems. It says it right at the top of the document.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. And I think the thing is, we can't carry on as we are, so let's try this. It will be messy. It will take... And this, when I say let's try this, this report is supposed to be the start of a conversation. Yes. It's not a set
again,
of...
Again, heavily emphasised in the document of like, we should... I mean, basically the closing bit in the document is, we need to start having this conversation now. I mean, he also says for when Labour's in government. Let's assume that's correct. Yeah. It's ready now.
Or later. It just, you know, whether you think it's going to be
2024
or not, that's a different matter.
And, you know, the idea, and I agree with them on this, if you think your party's going to, if you want to be a party of government and you want to get this stuff done, you need to be organised now. And he also emphasises not to wait to get it done. Do it quite early on in your term. And yes. I think... Probably when
that's what happened with Blair, wasn't it? He sort of had it all hanging around,
exactly.
But it hung around.
Yeah, but then in the end, they did some quite, you know, meaningful stuff. It's a bit, you know, it's a bit of a classic Blair thing of government thing of like, we did some quite radical things, but didn't quite go all the way.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We didn't implement gay marriage, but we did civil partnerships. There's loads of examples. And I think probably you can point to the Lib Dems in government that they... You know, this is a thing that heavily motivates Liberal Democrats, but they didn't get this stuff done when they had the political capital at the beginning. They didn't, you know, just sort of just had a referendum on a fairly uninspiring electoral system, which was never going to pass.
Yeah.
You know, you do have to get, if you want to do this stuff, you've got to get it done when you have all the political capital that comes with winning an election. My final question to you on this, and only you can answer this, in this podcast, is how seriously do you think people in the Labour Party take this stuff? Do you think it would get done if and when Labour come to power?
I think they do take it seriously. I don't think you do this, led by Gordon Brown, trumpeted in this way at this point in the electoral cycle, unless you think it's going to be the big change you make in government. And I think equally, none of this costs a lot. If the Labour Party are going to inherit an economy on its knees, all of the sort of spendy things that the Labour Party would want to do will be harder to do, certainly at the beginning. So if you need a big thing at the beginning to signal we are going to be a big change in government, then this is the thing that you can do.
Yep, that makes complete sense. I said that was going to be my final question, but actually I lied. Because there's a couple of other things I want to bring up about this. One, it did make me giggle reading the document that there was lots of references to New Britain, capital N, capital, of course, B, which made me chuckle for obvious reasons. I was just waiting for the document to start playing Things Can Only Get Better as I was reading it. The other thing that does worry me about this, and again, I'm naturally inclined, and I do think if the last few years have shown anything, we do need a big political shake-up that actually makes things better, not Brexit, which stifles everything. Anyway, we're not going to go down that road because you and I will just get very cross. I worry, like I think I wrote when I was making notes on the document, NIMBYs. Mm. Because if you have we talked about the need for house building many already quite a few times since we relaunched this show. This seems a kind of menu for NIMBYism. If you have loads of layers and loads of people trying to get elected at a local level.
Again, the devil will be on the detail.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where I think, and I have no insider knowledge, but here's how you get around that. you put house raiding targets in the same way that they were under the regional development agencies in under New Labour.
Oh my God, you're such a nerd.
I'm such a nerd. I work for local government think tank three. What happens to you? What you do is you put the target at a level that is a little bit untouchable from NIMBYs. And then the local council can say, oh, it's out of our hands. It's the regional development agency or whatever they call them under this scheme has set the target. We've got to build the houses. And it gives them the out to build the houses they desperately want to build because they know they actually need to, whilst also being able to say to the local idiots, sorry, nothing we can do.
Yeah. The other thing I did think was quite clever in this document was that it links improving the democratic state with improving the economic situation.
Yes, which... and I think that's absolutely right. I think one of the, I fundamentally link our over-centralised nation to our lack of productivity. I think if you can have more local imagination in terms of how you invest, how you work on local infrastructure, instead of doing big penis plans like HS whatever, 17,000, actually doing local infrastructure that will help local economies, I think that is really far, far better for improving our levels of productivity.
Yep, I think that's I did think it was quite clever to link the two and quite, you know, Gordon Brownish, and also quite a clever thing, because whatever we think of what's gone on the last few years, last few weeks, Labour always has to prove itself on the economy.
Yes. And it has to say, we are putting the economy at the heart of what we're doing. Yeah. And again, I mean, this is a conversation that you and I had before the podcast, but I think if you compare this with the financial deregulation that the Tories are currently putting through, you can make a really strong political case that Labour are going to invest in your local economy, whereas the Tories are just going to send us back to pre-2008 rules and line us up for the next crash. And I think that's a clever dividing line. And Gordon Brown was always very, very good. Whatever else you might think of him, the man could do a dividing line.
Talking of divisive figures and dividing lines... Matt Hancock is not standing as an MP again. Last week we did, I'm a Tory MP, get me out of here. He didn't say I'm a celebrity, get me out of here, but he said I'm out. He's not re-standing. We decided at the top of the show we were not going to spend a lot of time on this because we couldn't really cope.
Matt Hancock announcing that he's not going to be running as the Tory candidate for his seat is like me saying I'm not going to be the next face of Dior.
I think you'd be good at that.
I have no face for it in the same way that Matt Hancock doesn't currently have the whip and his local Tory association don't want him.
Yeah.
Dior haven't heard of me and I'm ugly. So,
Babe. I did think it was quite, I was going to say endearing, but I don't think it is. It was quite.
It's just classic dorky Matt.
Well, I think it's actually quite classic arrogance, actually, to decide that it was your decision.
Yeah,
clearly wasn't.
Matt Hancock has that combination of dorkiness and arrogance that sometimes works for some people for a while and then it massively crashes.
This was not in his gift to make this decision. When he left to go on TV, this decision was taken out of his hands.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he was not getting the Tory rep. I like the idea that was for him to send a letter to Rishi Sunak. It's like, can you imagine the Prime Minister getting that letter?
Can you imagine Rishi Sunak's face?
Someone,
the Alan Partridge gif made life.
Yeah, exactly. Someone did post that Alan Partridge gif on Twitter when this news broke. And I was like, yep, that sounds about right. Yep. I'm not sure the Prime Minister really cares because you would never get the whip. But there was quite a brutal letter actually from his local association, obviously, that went to the chief whip, who are basically like, nah. He's not coming back.
Yeah.
And as we know in the Conservative Party, once you lose the support of your local association, you're really done.
Yeah.
He was clearly done. So no more Matt Hancock.
Triggered.
He was. Well done.
For intents and purposes.
Yes, yeah. Well, it was sort of the equivalent of what your play lined out. And no more Matt Hancock. But it's okay though. He's going to save the world in other ways, he told us. So that's okay.
Well, because he mentioned dyslexia, all of twice on the show. I didn't watch it, but I did read the London Playbook updates. So.
Yeah. Talking of elections, in our first show, you and I mentioned the US midterms. Well, they finally bloody ended.
I know.
They finally bloody ended.
Poor Raphael Warnock must be the most knackered man in the USA.
Yeah, so Reverend Raphael Warnock has finally got a six-year term as the senator from Georgia. I think he's won five elections in 2 years to get to this point.
Absolutely crazy.
Because he was ahead on that midterms, in the like original midterms election, but didn't clear the 50% threshold.
Because there was a
libertarian candidate that got a couple of percentage.
3 or 4% of the vote.
I think it was less than that. I think it was only a couple of percent. And so they had to do a runoff. That is the rules in that state, which meant the poor guy had to keep going. Now, we're not going to get into Herschel Walker because A, he's finished and lost. And B, it's too early to cope with that. It's too depressing. But he has beaten a former, I think, college football star Herschel Walker, who is clearly not qualified to be a politician, but Trump endorsed.
He's qualified to be a human being.
Well, that's quite harsh, but yeah, he's not a very pleasant person. So the Reverend Raphael Warnock has won. He will finally get a seat after all these battles and national and local elections and Democratic primaries and goodness knows what. Will finally get a six-year term in the Senate. And it means, most importantly, that not only does he get to have a lie down for a little bit, but that the Democrats now have 51 seats in the Senate, which, although obviously with Kamala Harris as vice president, they effectively had 51 votes because she could always break a tie.
Yeah.
51, as I understand it, does make a difference in terms of speed, in terms of committees, in terms of, okay, if you lose a senator one way or the other on a piece of legislation, it doesn't matter.
Constantly in hock to Joe Manchin. If Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema were more in lockstep, they're still a bit in hock to them.
So just explain who they are. They're two of the more centrist.
The Georgia and somewhere else. And yeah, they're basically... Virginia.
Yeah. They're more centrist, West a bit...
The best thing I know about Joe Manchin, and the thing I like absolutely best about Joe Manchin, is that he has a yacht and it's called The Almost Heaven, which is a wonderful name when you know your John Denver lyrics.
Very good. So they're the more kind of centrist, contrarian, whichever way you want to put it, Democrats who can, if they want, put their foot, because it's so tight, could either individually or, as you say, working lots that put their foot down on certain pieces of legislation. That obviously this obviously shifts the power balance a little bit, given all the evidence suggests Raphael Warnock has voted I think he's got a 96% record, I read, voting in favour of Biden. That was one of the apparent tack lines on him, which did not work.
No.
So,
It does two things that are interesting, I think. One, it does slightly help the Democrats to get things through that they would have had to have convinced. So they can, if they can peel off Kirsten Sinema from Joe Manchin or Joe Manchin from Kirsten Sinema, they can get more stuff through. It also frees up Kamala Harris to have a higher profile because she's not constantly sitting around the Capitol waiting to see if she has to break a deadline.
So that's all quite significant, quite interesting. We'll see how that plays out over the next, first of all, 2 years, because they never stop having an election in the US. And actually, that was also kind of my point when we were talking about the reforms proposed originally, that there was sort of a sense that worried me that you'd just constantly be in election cycle if you had a Democratic, elected House of Lords. That's not a bad thing, because, as you said, democracy is, well, as you quoted, democracy is the worst system compared to all the others. The best system compared to all the others. Anyway, all quite interesting. Quite a relief, I would say, for Joe Biden to have got to this point. A relief.
It's going to give him a good 2 years to set up for whether he runs or whether someone else runs at the next election.
And also, of course, because of the way that election cycles work, presumably there will remain some kind of power base of Democrats. I can't remember who's up for election, but, they didn't lose a single seat. It's the first president since, like, 1930, I think, FDR, not to lose a senator.
Hasn't lost a single one and, in fact, gained one. All very good. I mean, the whole midterm cycle, as we said before, was very good news for the Democrats.
Well done, Donald
and
Trump.
And very bad news for the Republicans and, in particular, Donald Trump.
Well done, Donald Trump. Very good performance. Very good results. well played. Keep doing your thing. No, actually, please don't.
Keep it up.
No, please, maybe not. Just maybe shut up and go away, actually. Emma, always a pleasure. Glad you've had a good Friday morning. I don't know how else you would like to end it apart from talking to me. I can think of nothing better to do on a Friday morning than talk to you.
Absolutely.
Just remind people where they can keep up with you.
I'm on Twitter at @EmmaBurnell_, and you can sign up for my newsletter, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
All linked to in the show notes. I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on the Twitters. My Substack, because we all need one, is The Addition. Again, linked to in the show notes, The Addition with AWD.substack.com. And we will see you all next week.